This is Sarah Reif with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll hear from quilting artist Laura Fogg, who lived in a multi-generational home in Redwood Valley, and Mary Buckley, a writer and musician who came to Ukiah as a single mother in 1981. We'll start with Laura Fogg.
I grew up in Lafayette and went to UC Berkeley, and I hated Berkeley. I was there during the Vietnam War and the Cambodian invasion and got tear gassed a few times, and People's Park happened, and you know, it was pretty scary. There were tanks in the streets, and I got jumped a few times and had my apartment broken into, and you know, it was just too much in your face awful stuff. And then at that time, when my brother and I left for college, my mother immediately sold the house and moved up to Washington. So there was no, it didn't feel like home. There was no place to go to ever. So I met this man who was raised here, and he wanted to go back home. And I had been up here to visit his family. It was a large family. He had four siblings and grandparents all living on the property in Redwood Valley. And I just thought, oh, this, maybe this will be where I belong. And I just dove into it. So after I finished my master's, we just waited for that. And then the next day, we loaded up the old 53 pickup and rattled up Highway 101 and dumped it all off in Redwood Valley. We moved into his family home with both of his parents, his grandfather, and three younger siblings. And we ended up living in the downstairs unfinished area. We had to walk outside to get up. No heat downstairs, one wood-burning stove upstairs. So we all congregated around the stove. And 10 years and three kids later, we finally moved out of that house. It was a disaster for the marriage, but Redwood Valley became home. It's the best home I've ever had. His mother was a disciple of Alan Chadwick, and she was really into organic gardening, and she had a huge garden. It reminded me of my childhood in the East Bay Area before it got really populated. You know, cicadas clicking in the summer and those hot, lazy days, and you know, going to the swimming holes. You know, it reminded me of all of the good, kind of safe feeling stuff of growing up. And my mother did not garden. She was of Irish Welsh extraction, and was raised in very abusive rural poverty in Oregon. And she did not want to have anybody see that she couldn't afford to buy vegetables in the store. So she would garden flowers, but never vegetables. And I had always wanted to garden vegetables. So this was my chance to, you know, dive into that kind of an experience.
Aside from the gardening, how did you figure out how to get food together to feed you and your family in this new rural setting where you were gardening? Did you do hunting, or did you...
It wasn't that dramatic. Okay. There was a Safeway in town. Okay. But I was an original member of the what became the co-op, the Homestead Exchange, and you know, that just seemed like a lot of fun to... You know, go. I mean, it was fun at that time to, you know, go into town in that warehouse on the railroad tracks off Gobi Street, and you know, getting their big truck would show up, and a bunch of people would climb into the truck and slit open 50-pound bags of wheat and oats and barley and cornmeal and all that kind of stuff and divide it up. That was what we had to do to be part of it. So anyway, yeah. So food was not much of a problem, but. We preserved stuff that, I mean, we tried to be as independent as we could and grew just tons of stuff. And my mother-in-law and I would put up, I don't know, you know, 50 quarts of pears and 50 quarts of apples and applesauce and 50 quarts of apricot sauce. And just, we made pickles. And even though the UC Davis regulations came out about not doing cold-packed pickles because they weren't safe anymore because of botulism, you had to process them, and the pickles came out so limp. And we still made pickles, and we made zucchini pickles, and I hate zucchini pickles. But we just had this stuff. We had a whole warehouse just full of home canned stuff. And I remember going down there just looking at it and feeling so proud. And I still do that. I raised my kids canning. The first baby, when she was about 7 months old, I would put her in the kitchen sink. It was summertime. And I'd fill the sink with cold water and apples and the baby. And her first job was, you know, washing the apples. She'd bounce them around. And then the next year, she would sit at the table with us. And the second kid was in the sink bouncing apples. And she would sit at the table, and she would hand apples to me and hand apples to my mother-in-law to core and peel. And she would hand my mother-in-law all the really nice ones, and she'd give me all the really ugly, wormy ones. So anyway, yeah, food was fun, and I enjoyed learning a lot about cooking and, you know, making stuff from scratch. And we never called it a commune, but it was sort of a family commune.
And what about home births or medical treatments? Did you get involved in homeopathic treatments or kind of home remedies that were being revived at that time?
There wasn't that much yet, at least as far as I know, because my kids were born. The first one was born in 1974, and the cutting edge at that time was, if you were going to do a hospital birth, was to have your, to be more or less in control of your own labor, to not do anesthetic, and to have your husband in the delivery room. And that was, at least here in Ukiah, that was just about unheard of in 1974. And I had to do some fighting. I did want to have the kids in the hospital because I'm a special education teacher and acutely aware of what can happen if the infant, suffers anoxia or anything else. I had too many students whose disabilities were the result of anoxia at birth, and I just felt like I couldn't risk that. So anyway, we did the hospital births, but it was, we had Lamaze classes. I think I was one of the first wave of people who went through Lamaze classes here. And, I had to fight quite a bit in the hospital during the delivery to not get anesthetized. That was what the doctor, the OBGYN, wanted to do. And I just had to keep telling him, no, I'm going to handle this.
I'm fine.
Yeah, I'm fine. Don't, yeah. And they did, they were, not too sure about letting my husband in, but they ultimately did.
What about building your house? You said you eventually moved out of your in-laws' house and built your own place.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
We built it ourselves, and the kids helped. They got to help hammer nails into the subflooring and, get up on the roof and hammer on the roof sheathing, things that wouldn't show. When we were building the house, we had a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old and then an infant. So, the two little kids, got lots of smashed thumbs doing that job. And my father-in-law got involved in the building. So we did 100% of it ourselves. And it was a nice family project, though. And teaching my kids to grow stuff and cook their own food. And my daughter, she lives pretty much the way I lived in Redwood Valley. It's kind of at the end of the line. They are on the grid. They have power. But it's very, very remote, and she's homeschooling her kids, and they're growing an awful lot of what they do, and she cooks everything from scratch and, makes everything she possibly can. So, that was another part of this, that living in Redwood Valley, in addition to the gardening and the cooking, I even made the kids' underwear. I made t-shirts, I made pants, I made everything that everybody wore. So that helped me feel, again, just more connected and less of a user and more of a, if not giver, at least more of a participator. Now I do, it's art quilts. I did some art then. Working full time and raising the 3 kids and doing all this cooking and stuff took up just about all the time. There wasn't any time for anything. And sewing their clothes was kind of an outlet for some creative energy. And making stuffed animals, I made most of their toys too. Finally, when the kids left home, and I had sold the farmhouse, so I didn't have to maintain acreage. In Ukiah, they measure your property in feet instead of acres. And I just went, hallelujah, you know, what do I get to do with my time now? And then realized, oh, finally, I can go do the art that I've wanted to do. So that's really evolved. And interestingly, almost all the art I do is about the land and about what we can grow on our land. Those are the big themes. It's this, you know, this incredibly beautiful county. So yeah, the plants and the food and the land, those are the big themes.
So moving out a little bit more generally, what impact do you think the Back to the Land movement had on the culture of Mendocino County?
Oh, I think it was enormous, because when we moved up here, we were pretty much at the beginning of it, and the people who lived here were loggers. And the people who lived in town, many of them worked for Masonite, so that's logging related. Obviously, the service industries, the schools and social services. And then the farmers were mostly old families, a lot of Italian people in Calpella. I think a lot of people were very negative about all these dirty hippies. And then what I observed, though, was an awful lot of people started communicating and working together. Back in the early 70s, the Board of Supervisors was pretty much controlled by real estate interests. And there were some huge subdivisions that were being planned, one in Covelo that, you know, Brook Trails subdivision had gone in Willits. And, you know, people were beginning to realize how bad that could be. So the Environmental Quality Coalition was mostly people of the Back to the Land age, and they actually were able to stop this ridiculous thing from going in Covelo. We certainly had some effect on growing grapes and other produce organically. And my family, the grapes they had were, somebody else was the manager, and the grapes were not grown organically until many, many years later. But the whole idea of organic gardening and, you know, wanting to have a place where we could, a store where we could buy organic produce, which became the co-op. And then ultimately, even the big markets like Safeway has, you know, an arguably organic section.
Do you have a memory of anything that's like especially emblematic of that era, that when someone says Back to the Land or the 70s, is what pops into your mind?
Oh, I guess a couple of things. One of them is just skinny dipping. We didn't do that in the suburbs and the East Bay. I mean, it wasn't done. And, you know, coming up here, you go to a party at somebody's place and everything comes off, and it was just a hoot. You know, my kid generation are so much more prudish. They won't go skinny dipping, as far as I know. So anyway, now that's a big memory. And then just loving the harvest. I just absolutely adore it. And again, the memory is sort of a visceral one. Is, and you know, the smells of, you know, hot dirt and hot apples in, you know, baking in the sun with the cicadas clicking. It's, you know, it just seems so it's peaceful, and it's very animated at the same time for me.
We just heard from some of Laura Fogg's recollections about being a Back to the Lander in Redwood Valley. Now we'll turn to Mary Buckley, who heard about Ukiah during her last year at Oxford. She came to town in 1981 and made her home at the headwaters of Robinson Creek.
I had never been here and didn't really know what I was getting into at all, much like most things in life. I grew up in the 60s on the south side of Chicago, and it was actually a dangerous time and place, racial tensions and riots and crime, and it was dirty and dangerous. Chicago's actually nicer now than it was when I left, but I wanted someplace that was peaceful, safe, clean, beautiful, healthy. To raise kids was the main thing I was thinking. It took a couple of years to find what became my home at Stone's Throw, a community outside Ukiah. My house was built in, what became my house was built in probably 77 or so. It was originally just a hexagon, maybe, I don't know, 15 or 20 feet across, and with a loft, and that was it. It was a one-person house, and then someone else came along and took off the four French doors that were two of the walls of the hexagon, and added on a kind of a triangular-shaped room, roughly shaped, just kind of poking out into the trees where the hill sloped away, so you felt like you were kind of up in the air, and he turned those French doors sideways so that they could open out, and then put another row of windows above them, which I eventually actually put glass into. When I moved there, it was stapled up glass, and one of the windows was denim, and another was a tarp, and, you know, it was just bits, and there were some trees growing through the house. They hadn't wanted to take out the madrones, and they are such special and beautiful trees. I don't blame them, except that eventually I had to take them out because they were, you know, pressing up against the house and inviting aphids and leaking around the edges and just not very happy. I wouldn't recommend building a house around a tree, but they did call it the tree house, partly for that reason and partly because the what I used as the bedroom, you know, the main room with all the windows, I had a bed built into that triangular corner, and it felt like you were kind of up in the air in the trees. And like most hand-built houses, there was hardly a right angle in the whole place, and carpenters would always complain when they worked on it. But the community was mostly based on what we shared was wanting a good place for our kids, so it was very compatible that way. I don't know if you'd call it intentional community in any other sense, but just that we wanted a nice place to raise kids, and we wanted to share what resources we had, you know, free box and diapers and child care and work parties and potluck dinners and rides to town and, you know, jump start the car if you need it and that kind of thing. I could never have raised my kids by myself as a single mom out in the hills, you know, in the woods, just us. That it just wouldn't have worked. But with six families on the land, there was always a pack of kids around, so I knew the kids were fine. They'd just go out to play, and I knew they'd find each other, and they'd maybe stop by for, I had six or eight kids for lunch, and then they'd disappear again, or they'd hang out in our house for a while, and we knew they were taken care of and safe, and that the other adults were not far away. There were about five of the six houses were on just a few acres worth, so it was, they were close enough to, like, see the other houses through the trees and for little kids to walk back and forth. One of them was a little further out at the edge of the property, but it was really a pretty perfect little village for sharing child raising, as it turned out.
So how did you make it work financially?
I was pretty independent minded, and I did not want to be on welfare, even though I was, you know, a single mom with two little kids. I decided I'm going to just work and barter and do what I have to do to make it work. And a large part of that was just not spending much money. My first year or so there, I bartered for my rent, which was $100 a month. And we bought it about 2 years later. And we're all panicked, like, oh no, where are six families going to come up with $140,000 to buy this property? So my share was $23,000, and it seemed astronomical. I couldn't imagine. But I was working the whole time. I think the first 6 months I was kind of coasting on just trading for various, you know, babysitting and that kind of thing. That was how I paid the rent the first few months. And when I finally realized I needed breaks, because we had to drive to town. I'd go to town once a week to do laundry and shopping. And it's a fair amount of dirt road driving. And eventually I realized, oh no, $150 for breaks. What am I going to do? So I got a couple of jobs. I worked as an acupuncture assistant for Dr. Grace Liu at the acupuncture clinic. And then I added on another day a week when a neighbor, John Takis, who was installing solar electric systems, put in my little tiny solar electric system for my cabin. He didn't want me to pay him back. He was a very generous guy. And I said, no, I have to pay you back. But I was giving him garden baskets because I was growing lots of vegetables. And I realized it would take a long time to, you know, pay off $1,000, like, again, really astronomical sum. And his partner, Pat Lawrence, said, well, you've worked in bookkeeping on offices before, and they also had a bookkeeping and tax preparation service, and I worked for them, and I liked them a lot, so I worked with them. And then I started working for New Dimensions Radio.
There are some great pictures of your kids, like one of them is very studiously hammering a nail when she's about 4 years old. So what kinds of skills did your kids get from the experience?
That picture was taken when I was having some carpentry done around the house, whether I was doing it myself or having somebody working on it, which happened a lot. So there were probably just hammers and nails lying around and some boards, and she discovered the joy of hammering nails into boards, and she would do these, a whole board full of nails, and then she would zigzag string between the nails and make little musical instruments or little games or little art pieces or something like that. Yeah, I can't say that there was a whole lot of skill going on, mine or theirs, but we got by.
There were also some kids that were born on the community, and you assisted in that. Can you talk about that experience?
Some of the kids were born there, and one of them I delivered, not because I had any particular background or skill. Again, I think it was more a matter of youth and ignorance and boldness than anything. It wasn't like, oh, this is a good idea, let's do it because we're doing it the right way. It was more like, oh, okay, well, let's see what happens and let's try it. During the period just before I moved there, we were traveling, and I lived at a hot springs near Mount Shasta for a while. And my younger daughter was about 6 months old when this couple arrived, just kind of gypsying around, and 7 months pregnant, I think, at the time. And within a couple months, they had their baby, and I helped deliver it because I had just had a baby and had read lots of books and, you know, knew a little bit about it, which, of course, is a dangerous thing. But luckily, she was young and healthy, and it all went smoothly. And then she sought me out a couple years later, but by that time, I was living at Stone's Throw. And I think she and her husband, 9 months pregnant, just came to the co-op and started asking around, there's this place called Stone's Throw. Anybody know Mary? So they actually found me, and I was in Chicago at the time visiting my sister. And she and her husband and a couple of her kids and a couple of my kids, I'm not, I don't remember how many we had at that time, but we all drove across country in a big station wagon, camping along the way. And we arrived, we were met by one of the neighbors near the front gate, and he said, I hope you don't mind, there's some people staying at your house. They're 9 months pregnant, and they just showed up and said they knew you, and we just couldn't turn them away, so they're still there, and we didn't know when you were coming back. So we found them there, naked, having a picnic on the front porch, and very 9 months pregnant. And my brother-in-law turned around and said, I'm going back to town and staying with our friends in town. So my sister and I and the kids stayed there with them. And 2 days later, 2 mornings later, she went into labor, and I asked if she wanted a ride to town, and she said, no. And I said, would you like me to call midwives or doctor or anything? No. And they had just been, you know, traveling and didn't have any insurance or any money. And I said, well, would you like me to stay home from work? And yes, could you? So I delivered a baby in the meadow a few hours later. And again, luckily she was healthy. There were some complications, and I ended up, actually the baby was eventually delivered fine. It took a while coming out. And I remember thinking, okay, I remember reading somewhere that it's okay if they're blue. They've got 7 minutes without oxygen before there's brain damage. And, you know, just trying to think, okay, don't panic. What, you know, what do we need to do here? And then eventually the baby was born and it was fine. But then the placenta didn't deliver. And I knew not to pull on the umbilical cord. I knew somebody almost died that way when the uterus, inverted and prolapsed. And so I knew not to do that. So I called Lynn Meadows, our midwife extraordinaire, on the first cell phone I'd ever seen. It was one of those huge clunky things that looked like it was from World War II or something. And it was radio phone, I guess. It wasn't really a cell phone. But anyway, I took it out in the meadow where we did the delivery. And I said, so can you tell me what to do here? And she described, oh, well, you hold on to the uterus. You know, you feel it from the stomach, you know, from outside. And then you can pull, you know, and it's still prolapsed. So you just push it back in and then massage it till it feels like an orange. And so she kind of talked me through the whole process. And luckily she wasn't hemorrhaging or anything. I mean, if she'd been bleeding, we would have been out of there right away. I knew that that was a danger sign, of course. But it turned out fine, and she didn't get an infection, and she didn't, you know, the she ended up just fine. And I think now I would, of course, know better than to try to do that. But at the time, I was like, okay, why not? La, la, la. Let's just do this. And it worked. And we were more lucky than smart, I think. But it worked. And that little baby came to visit us a couple of years ago. She was living in Humboldt County and doing really well and really great kid.
From your perspective, of course, being an adult, what was it like being a kid out there?
Well, we were in a very tiny house, so we didn't have much room for anything. I remember we had one box of toys. That was it when they were growing up. So, of course, naturally, they tended to play outside. Lots of trees. And in the summer, we had apples and plums and pears to climb for, and walnuts in the fall. And so they did a lot of tree climbing. There was a creek, Robinson Creek. Actually, geographically, you can't get there from Robinson Creek Road, but geographically, it's at the headwaters of Robinson Creek. So they would play in the creek, and they had rocks that were different colors, and they would scrape them and make a mud, like a paste clay, and paint their bodies. They had gray and brown and pink and yellow and kind of bluish, and they'd find all these different colors of rocks and clay and do these amazing body paintings. And often, of course, they would just do it with paint. We had some very creative body painting going on. There was one day when three of the girls painted themselves all over in matching patterns, so that each of them had like a little landscape on her chest and little circles on her bottom, and you know, and a necklace painted on. It was wonderful.
Why did you leave?
Well, who knew those kids were going to turn into teenagers? I guess I hadn't really thought it through, or I guess I just assumed that we'd always be there until I had grandkids, you know, rock around the porch kind of thing. But when the kids are teenagers, we all discovered that actually it was like dominoes one after another. We ended up moving into town because they just really don't want to play and paint their bodies with clay anymore and climb trees. You know, they really want to do the social things. They had the dance classes and theater things and sports and whatever else they were doing. And they really needed to be in town more. So by that time I was working practically 5 days a week, I think. And we did a lot of driving. And I remember sitting there one day after dinner and looking up at the skylights over the kitchen table and seeing a bunch of cobwebs and thinking, you know, I don't live here anymore. I'm not even here often enough to clean out the cobwebs. We come home and then start the fire and make dinner and go to bed and wake up, make the fire, have breakfast and leave. And it was very sad. It was very difficult. I tried, and it took me a couple of years to admit it and, you know, actually decide to do it. During that time, I rented a room in a friend's house in town, two different friends' houses. We tried this and we tried that, but that was like moving twice a week, you know. Do you have your dance clothes? Do you have your school books? Do you have your homework? Have we got our groceries? Have we got our laundry? You know, it was just more than it was worth dealing with because they just needed to be in town, as I said. So we moved to town.
Was so little and fine. It's sweet and it's good and it's mine. They hadn't been sweeping the leaves off the porch. I'd care for it better. I'd keep it all neat. It's mine and it's good. There's a loft and skylights and windows galore. The spaces are open with beautiful wood. It's sweet and it's mine and it's good.
You've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We just heard from Laura Fogg and Mary Buckley, who shared her original song with us at the end. You can catch short excerpts during the news hour on Thursdays and longer episodes at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. They're also on our website and Facebook page, with pictures and complete versions of each interview. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.